Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to the witnesses. You've painted, all of you collectively, a picture of what the roller coaster looks like for the future, and I think that's the most challenging thing for us to get our minds around, is that the roller coaster is going to continue. So for consumers at home, it obviously can be very, very devastating. And so to me, I think Mr. Bordoff, you said it best, that the best thing we can do is diversify off of oil, just because of that integrated market and now spare capacity issue, that even though we have upped production, we are not going to avoid still being wrapped around that global market and the challenges of that global market. So one thing I wanted to ask about, obviously everybody's talked a lot about Iran. When we were focusing on high prices during the, a decade ago, one of the issues that people put, or at least a lot of the oil executives would say, there is a terrorist premium, a threat of terrorism activity disrupting supply. And so they would say that there's something between a 15 and 20% increase in price just based on that fear factor. Do you have some sense of what the Iranian issue might be causing in the market today? Yes, Mr. Bordoff.
It's hard to put a dollar figure on it. We do see oil prices move in response to signals from the administration that the they will take a harder or softer line toward implementing sanctions. A few weeks ago, when an unnamed State Department official was giving an anonymous briefing and said there would be no exceptions for significant reductions in Iranian oil purchases, so countries had to go to zero by November, we saw oil prices spike several dollars a barrel. I don't remember how much exactly, and then the administration seemed to walk that back a little bit. So I do think that tool is an important one we should remember. I think that the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is designed to deal with short-term, temporary, severe supply disruptions, not the potential for a long-term supply loss from implementing sanctions against any country, against their oil supply. The Iran statute was written with a mechanism built into it to try to take account of conditions in the global oil market and make sure we were imposing pain on Iran without imposing shooting ourselves in the foot at the same time.
But you're saying both trade wars and this issue are causing some level of increase in price.
Well, I think recently it's had a little bit of the opposite effect, because the new sanctions that were announced against the new tariffs that were announced against additional Chinese goods raised fear that the trade war could be worse, and that might have a negative effect on global economic growth. And the rate of GDP growth is one very important factor in how strong oil demand growth is, which could push up prices in a tightly balanced market. So there are a lot of geopolitical risks out there. Obviously, Iran is one, Libya is another, Venezuela is another, and general potential for increased tensions or conflict in the Middle East or elsewhere, as we've seen in social media and other places in the last few days.
So what did we get out of the $4 billion tax break, the new tax break and the tax plan that we gave oil companies? What did we get out of that? You know, in the context of here we are months later, we gave a $4 billion tax break, a new one, in addition to, you know, the lowering of the corporate rate. We gave them additional foreign investors, and yet here we are paying higher gas prices. So what did we get out of that?
Well, it's hard. I don't know that I can comment specifically on what was in the tax bill. The general point about increased production and to what extent it helps consumers at the pump. I think in your opening remarks you made the comment about how we have increased production and yet prices have still gone up. That's partly because prices are set in a global market. There's a limit to what shale can do, as extraordinary as doubling oil production has been. I mean, this is the largest five-year increase of oil production of any country in history. That is a staggering turnaround from what the outlook was not long ago. And I think it's fair to say that if that had not happened, we'd be facing a different oil price outlook right now.
Well, I guess I would say I don't think that's fair use of the taxpayer money to give these oil companies a huge tax break, and now we're seeing a spike in prices. I would have preferred us to think about this issue of what can we do on the spare capacity side? What more can we do? If the SPRO writ large is this issue, and there's lots of you know, the chair and I both very interested in making sure that we worked with Secretary Moniz at the time to increase the infrastructure so that it was robust enough for us. But what about the way Europeans look at jet oil fuel? Why not look at creating more mechanisms for industry to have more spare capacity? They have a reserve as it relates to, we're not at that point yet, but definitely the last decade was a huge roller coaster for the airline industry because of high fuel costs. A lot of people lost their jobs, lost their pensions, lost everything because of that spike. So what can we do now to help create, if spare capacity is such a big issue that's controlled by somebody else, the Saudis, not us, what can we do?
We don't have the ability that a company that controls its national oil production has to hold back spare capacity. The responsiveness of shale and the extent to which shale grows is determined by the individual economic decisions of thousands of independent actors throughout the United States. Companies hold some level of inventory that makes sense for them. We have government-held stocks, which I think are more responsive than privately-held stocks when they are used by the government, but that is, again, sort of extraordinary circumstances. So it raises the question of whether government's role is actually to provide oil price stability moving forward and whether there are other actions we can take to reduce how exposed our economy is because of how dependent we are on oil. I was just going to make one other point, which is we're sort of talking about to what extent shale can be a swing supply source and ramp up and down quickly, and if it can, it could sort of vanquish the role OPEC or others could have. That comes at a cost, and I don't need to tell senators here from oil-producing states, to U.S. communities. I mean, when truck drivers are making six-figure salaries and then they lose their jobs, when the school funding base soars and then collapses, volatility in oil output can be different for communities to manage, even though it may have a benefit in stabilizing global prices.
I'm way over, but I would just say, yes, I endorsed your statement that the best thing to do is, you know, get us off the roller coaster by diversifying off of oil. So I endorse that. In the meantime, though, I do think we should be, I'll write something for a question for the record, Madam Chair, on this issue, but I do think that Europe has looked at jet fuel as a specific way of increasing supply, and so we'll ask that for the record. Thank you. I think the issue for us in Washington, since we're paying, I think, $452 million more this year than last year, is the roller coaster that you all described and how we continue to diversify from our fuel sources and get off of it. So for us, because we have very affordable electricity as it is today and a very high percentage of our consumers driving electric cars, I think we see the transition in the Northwest. Some great companies, even in the trucking industry, like PACCAR, making great energy efficiency moves. So we're definitely going to go as fast as we can. I wanted to ask Mr. Bordoff, I asked in the my opening statement about the high volume of trading that's going on and whether that was something that we needed to take a look at. I think for the volume of West Texas intermediate trades has dramatically increased over the last 5 years. I think they've seen something like a 276% increase in the number of trades per minute. Is this something that the CFTC should be looking at and just making sure that the automatic trading process is not creating some spikes in or distorting the market from true supply and demand fundamentals?
Thank you for the question, Ranking Member Cantwell. So this is not an issue that we've studied carefully. I will caveat with that. It is true that algorithmic trading activity has increased significantly in commodity markets, commodity derivatives markets since 2008. As in many other financial markets. And I think the behavior of this type of trader, the implications of this type of market participation certainly merit further research. I think it's been limited to date in part by poor data transparency. I'm not aware of studies on this issue. Anecdotally, I've heard market participants suggest a view that algorithmic trading may lead to sharper commodity price swings. And volatility. There was a research note from Citigroup just a week or two ago noting that some of the recent sharp sell-off in crude the week before seemed to have stemmed in part, at least in part, by some element of machine trading. I will note, I think it's important to recognize that even if algorithmic trading leads to greater very short-term price swings in traded benchmark crude prices, and my colleagues may have a view on this too, that doesn't necessarily mean those price moves affect the price of physical barrels paid by refiners and therefore the price we're paying at the pump. So I think that too would be a question worthy of further study.
Well, I was just going to say before Mr. Brazil raised his hand, I'll bet you he does have something to say about this, because I think those who've been in the business have seen the unbelievable actions of the financial markets have grave impacts. So, Mr. Brazil.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier I spent 15 years as a trader, so I've kind of been on the other side of this thing. More trading volume in a futures market and any kind of electronic market is actually a good thing. It's because it creates more liquidity in that market. So the market becomes more responsive to supply and demand. And getting back to what Jason was talking about, you want your financial markets to be reflective of what goes on in the physical markets. And the higher level of volatility, the higher level of trading that you have, the more likely that will be. The volatility comes from what's going on in the supply-demand scenario itself that we've been talking about all morning. In terms of the electronic trading, the algorithmic trading, the changes that happened in seconds. So whenever EIA kicks out a new statistic, the price might jump a few dollars because of the algos getting in there, but that impact goes away very quickly. So from the CFTC's perspective, they certainly may need to look at it, but from a market perspective, like what we've been talking about in the morning, it's pretty much a non-event.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely follow up with the CFTC. I know they've had one case already where they had a settlement where they were concerned about somebody impacting that. And I think the thing that we've learned is when the tighter the markets, the more you want to have transparency to make sure that they're not affected. So, Madam Chair, thanks for the hearing this morning. I definitely think there's lots to do to continue to focus on this issue. We certainly need to make sure that we're having, I think our colleagues have done a good job of bringing up these other issues of investment for the future. So I hope that we'll look at that maybe as a follow-up hearing.